Hello, this is the Business Marketing Club podcast. If you've heard us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. If this is the first time you've heard us, well, you're very welcome. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips for the business marketing community. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a business marketer, and I'm chair and co-founder of the Business Marketing Club Community Network. Are you listening comfortably? Then we'll begin. My guest today is a legend in marketing circles. Malcolm McDonald is Emeritus Professor of Cranfield University School of Management, formerly Marketing and Sales Director of Canada Dry, now a professor at six of the UK's top business schools and chairman of four companies. His Marketing Plans book is the most regularly thumbed tome in my marketing library. And I'd like to therefore welcome you to our podcast today. Malcolm McDonald, welcome.
Thank you, Dave.
Actually, it's with that Marketing Plans book that I'd like to kind of focus first of all, because your book goes into good detail on marketing plans and practically how to put them together and to use them. Can you summarize your approach to marketing planning for those not familiar with the book?
Okay, well, it's fairly simple, in the sense that it sets out a logical and systematic process for dealing with, well, the market and environmental uncertainty and setting out processes for dealing with it. But it starts with an audit or a situation review of the environment and the markets that you address and competitors and, of course, your own position in it. It then moves on to set objectives for the future, covering a period of about 3 years at least, for what you're going to sell and who you're going to sell it to. It then sets out strategies for achieving the objectives. Now, we would know them, and listeners would know them as the four P's. Those who suffer from an awful sense of inflation have got seven P's, but I don't believe in all of that. There's nothing wrong with the product.
Keep it simple.
And promotion. Nothing wrong with that at all. And it served me well for 600 years. So I stick with that. It then sets out, as I say, the strategies, the four P's for how you're going to achieve the objectives. And then it costs it all out in the form of budgets and establishes whether the plan is going to create shareholder value. But the final step, having set the strategic plan, is it's a phase that involves a detailed scheduling and costing out of the actions required for implementing the first year of the plan. And that's important, Dave, because the book, I mean, it's a book on strategic planning. It's not a book on forecasting and budgeting and one-year plans. There is a whole section of how you prepare a detailed one-year plan, which I'll talk about later. But the most important thing is it sets out an approach to an uncertain future and shows you how to deal with it. And I will just say this, if you don't mind my saying so, since you very kindly mentioned the book, it has sold about 500,000 copies worldwide, and it's been translated into every language that on planet Earth, more or less, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies, the big ones, you know, big global companies, use my process as the basis for their strategic planning systems. So it's certainly well tried and tested, and we know it works. So I hope that's a reasonable answer to the question.
That's great. And I'd like to come back in a moment, actually, to marketers using your approach. But perhaps before we get there, could you take us through what the benefits are of having a good strategic marketing plan?
Oh, well, I love to see the fog lifting from the faces of chief execs and chief financial officers when I go through what world-class marketing is in the form of a strategic marketing plan. And it's lovely when I get hundreds and hundreds of emails afterwards from the chief execs and chief finance officers saying that They now understand what real marketing is, and they know how it should be done. And it's changed their companies and it's changed their lives. And that's a great pleasure for that. But the real benefit is that, you know, it's knowing how we intend to create shareholder value, which is what business is all about, and what resources we need to invest in to achieve our objectives. And, you know, research over the past 50 years, Dave, you know, I've got so much, as you know, I did a PhD on this topic in the 80s. There's so much research over the past 50 years to prove that strategic marketing plans, when done properly, leads to commercial success. I'm not going to bore the listeners with what those scholarly references are, but they'll just have to trust me because I'm a doctor, doctor, doctor.
That's good enough for me. So going back to your book, my copy of your book, and this probably dates me, goes back to 1996. But still today, the practice of strategic marketing planning is one that I find marketers are still vague on, to the extent that when I ask for a marketing plan from a marketing team, typically I get lots of different approaches and different results. Why do you think the concept struggles to take root amongst the marketing community?
Well, it's a bit, Dave, like most things in life that are difficult. Some things in life are easy and we do lots of them. And I won't embarrass you and the listeners by saying what those things are. But strategic marketing planning, it takes time and skills. And if you're not prepared to make the investment, it's just not going to happen. But it's the thing is, it's exactly the same in all disciplines, but particularly in marketing. I mean, you take, let me give you sort of three fairly simple basic examples of this. If you take something like customer profitability, the reality is that most companies in 2020 still measure customer profitability and they call that profit. Now that's got to be done, of course, but it's got very little to do with making profit. And I'll give you an example, which I might have given on my webinar that I did a few months ago, but I'll give you an example. Let's say when I was marketing and sales director of Canada, I would take two customers like Sainsbury and Tesco. These, of course, for people who don't live in the UK, are major supermarket groups. Well, Tesco used to insist on daily just-in-time store-by-store delivery. It cost me a fortune. They used to insist on my Salesforce calling to do things. In those days, it was called merchandising. That cost me a fortune. There were other things, of course, but they used to take about 140 days to pay their accounts. You get some ingenue who's probably been to a lesser business school. He says, well, why do you deal with them? And the answer is, oh, I'm going to stab myself in the eye with a fork when somebody wants to know why a customer that's doing 3 million dozen with you, if you don't drop them. But against that, you get somebody like Sainsbury. You know, they said, keep your working class sales force away from my lovely upmarket stores. We don't want them. So that saved me a fortune. They said, keep your tacky lorries away from my lovely upmarket stores. Just send them to our central warehouse, which was one lorry, one invoice, brilliant. And they paid their accounts in about 35 days. And the point I'm making, David, is what is it that makes profit for a company? It's not your wretched products, although you've got to know the margin. It's the cost of serving your customers after the product's left the factory. And that's where, you know, that's real profitability. And I talk to chief marketing officers and finance officers, chief finance officers and chief executive officers, explain this. And it is amazing what they discover, where they really make their money and where they lose money when they do what I call activity-based costing. But what I'm saying is activity-based costing, it's not easy. And you take something else, something simple like customer retention, you know, the Bain and Company stuff. I can't believe that Harvard Business Review and Bain and Forrester and IBM and the likes are wrong when they say that, you know, if you can lose 5% fewer customers each year, your profits will go up by about 75%. And the reality is, I know this because I spend much of my life at these big conferences where I use audience response systems. And I know that very, very, very few companies ever record and report to the board customers they've lost. It's much more heroic to report to the board customers they've won. And yet again, it has a major impact on the bottom line, but it's difficult. And just one last example, financially quantified value propositions. Again, my research and McKinsey show about 2% of companies in the United Kingdom have got financially quantified value propositions. Why? Because it's difficult to do. It's a bit like, you know, strategic marketing planning. It's not easy to do. And I say, you know, if you want to do it, you've got to have the knowledge, you've got to have the skills, and you've got to have the perseverance. And, you know, all I'm saying is the reasons are there are very few professionally qualified people in the marketing community, which I think is a great shame. I mean, I wouldn't personally want an operation on my brain if the surgeon wasn't a qualified brain surgeon. But in marketing, it doesn't seem to matter. They're called marketing. Oh, we'll let them loose and we'll let them spend loads and loads of money without any justification. And then you get the accountants. I love accountants, but you get all this short-termism. Short-termism is the bane of our lives. It's written about in most of the management journals and the academic journals. And I tell you what, it's amazing that when you think about it, forecasting and budgeting, short-termism, we know it doesn't work. And if you look at what the accountants do with their wretched cost-cutting, I call it anorexia industrialosa, which is an excessive desire to be leaner and fitter, leading to emaciation and eventually death. I mean, how many pence are there in a pound? How many cents are there in a euro? And so on and so forth. You know, how many of those can you cut? Whereas what we do in marketing, which is where the difficulty sets in, we're there to create value for customers. And that's infinite and is only limited by our creativity and imagination. So it's difficult. Now, just one last point about this. So for take a strategic plan and prove that it creates shareholder value is not the easiest thing in the world. I've written a whole book about it, which I might refer to later, sponsored by the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants. But the point is, Dave, it's difficult. And it's even more difficult when you get a big chunk of the marketing community don't even know what the cost of capital is. So I mustn't get too much on my high horse, just in answer to one question. So let's draw a little line under that question.
Let's move on. The talk of writers in marketing in recent years, like Scott Brinker, has been around the topic of agile marketing practices. So how you can bring in the practices familiar in the software space into marketing to make marketing smarter and faster and more innovative. Do you think these agile practices fit with the good strategic marketing planning that you advocate?
Not really, no, not at all, in fact, because, you know, the dreaded agile, faster, smarter, more innovative, to use your words, you know, for every one person who does it successfully, there's a million other people who do it unsuccessfully. They're just like headless chickens, you know, I call poultry in motion. You know, they're doing the wrong thing quickly. And I mean, what could be more stupid in life, Dave, than doing the wrong thing quickly and agilely? But, you know, if you go back to hundreds of years before Christ, Sun Tzu said in the art of war, he said, tactics without strategy is the noise before defeat. And, you know, it's quite interesting when you look at history and the history of business. I mean, to address the nub of your question, obviously the need to be responsive and immediate can't be accommodated by control over, centrally by control over messages. But it was ever like that. When our Cranfield research shows that chief marketing officers see their roles inspiring thousands in the organization to communicate consistent brand values and messages. That's different. And I've got an article which I came across recently. I've got it in front of me. It's by Jarrett in July 2019. And he compares this situation as being like a human without a brain, who would be just a collection of activities that can't operate. And he says, likewise, a global marketing team needs a strategic plan a North Star to gather round, something that will guide compliance and accountability. So there remains a need to put in place consistent processes, systems and tools to enable marketing organizations to maximize effectiveness. Thus, the need for strategic planning, marketing planning, will always be a required skill of chief marketing officers. In other words, we need to get back to the fundamental foundations of marketing strategy. And I must say, Dave, that, you know, since, you know, apart from, you know, years and years and years of working with the world's top companies, recently I've been interacting with lots and lots of leaders via the medium of webinars on Zoom. And I must say, you know, this is since the lockdown, it's convinced me even more that the skill of developing strategic marketing plans is in greater demand today than at any time in the history of marketing. So whilst the uncertainty about what the future holds for many of us will remain for some time, the only difference is that such plans will need to be more carefully and regularly monitored. But I'll just say that, you know, it does fit in, obviously, and we mustn't confuse strategic plans with tactical plans. In my book, you get a detailed template for setting out a one-year tactical plan. That's the first year of the strategy. And that one-year plan has got assumptions in it and it's got contingency plans. That's where the agility comes in. But you're doing it against a rational background. That's the point. And you know, it raises the question, I think, very briefly, Dave, what the hell is strategy anyway? And the answer is strategy is doing the right things. And what's tactics? Doing things right. Now, what could be worse, as I said earlier on, than doing the wrong thing well? It's a bit like asking, you know, it's a bit like asking a stupid salesperson to work hard, you know, double the chaos and offend twice as many customers. So we have to use a little bit of common sense about this agility. I'm all for it. I'm all for agility, but against a rational set of objectives and strategies that are going to take you in the direction the company needs to go in. But yes, by all means, let's be agile and so on and so forth.
So for marketers who are listening to this and hopefully have gone out and got your book on marketing planning, how should marketers get started with putting together a strategic marketing plan?
Yeah, another difficult one. How on earth? I get asked this question perhaps more than any other question when I've been around these companies all over the world. And I mean, the first point I would make is I say education, education, education. You've got to get the knowledge and skills. There's no point in trying to guide a company's strategy if you don't understand business, and particularly if you don't understand marketing. So it's education, which you can get, of course, from things like the book. You can get it from courses. You can get it from my online courses. So, you know, particularly important today where you can't turn up for face-to-face meetings, but you can get them online. And I say, you know, then you've got to do it once you've learned how to do it. And I say to people, don't try and change the whole world in one go. Start on a product for market, which is reasonably important, and do a strategic plan for that to test it out. And, you know, try it out on the people who are, you know, the opinion leaders, the people who've got the budgets. Don't try and change the world overnight. In other words, start small and then work your way out once you've proved the process works.
That's great. Let's move away from marketing planning a little now to talk about profitable growth. You've always maintained, I think, a close link between academic rigor and commercial application. And that has included an extensive body of work around how marketing can support profitable growth. Can you take us through some of those findings?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, I've uncovered something like 300 fads, Dave. Fads, you know, consultant fads over the past 50 years. You wouldn't believe it. Things like In Search of Excellence, where there were 46 excellent companies, and 8 years later, there are only six left. And you had silly things like, you know, totally silly things like management by wandering around, would you believe, MBWA. And that, and I was with an audience once, and I mentioned MBWA in a jocular way, and somebody said, oh, we're far more sophisticated than that, Malcolm. We do MBFA. And it was a mixed audience, so I was a bit worried about what MBFA was. And I said, what do you mean MBFA? And he said, management by flying around. Then my heart started beating again, because I really... And then you get the one-minute manager, and oh God, I'm going to stab myself in the eye with a fork with all this stuff. So we talk about profitable growth. What I've got, and I certainly wouldn't bore any listeners with it, but I've got 127 scholarly references to show that in marketing, the direct link between long-term financial success and marketing is a deep understanding of the market, as opposed to wittering on about your wretched products all the time. Because all products today are excellent, and you're not going to get any differential advantage from that. You're going to get it from the way you relate to your customers, not through your product. Then you get proper needs-based segmentation, not the garbage that passes for needs-based for segmentation like socioeconomics and demographics and so on and so forth. And then you get differentiation, positioning, and branding. Now, these things are the heart and soul of marketing strategy. And how do you prove the success? Well, the answer is you prove it through shareholder value added. Whether we like it or not, it started with Rapoport in the 80s, economic value added, and became shareholder value added. But shareholder value added, having taken account of the risks with your strategies, the time value of money, and the cost of capital, of course. And I just sent this little note here. I sent out to my LinkedIn colleagues just a few days ago. And I'll just read this tiny little bit. It said, the most common objective of modern commercial organizations is the sustainable creation of shareholder value. This can be achieved only by providing shareholders with a total return from capital growth and dividend yield that exceeds their risk-adjusted required rate of return for this particular investment. In today's highly competitive environment, the major sources of shareholder value creation are the intangible assets of the business, such as brands, customer relationships, and channels of distribution, the 80% of the company's value that doesn't appear on the traditional balance sheet. Consequently, the critical future marketing strategies of a company, which indicate how these assets are to be developed, maintained, and exploited, are the role of properly trained marketing specialists, not some geek playing around with technology. And, you know, you look at companies like Procter & Gamble. I know we're business to business, but Procter & Gamble, one of the most famous companies in the world, if you look at that, I mean, they paid £31 billion for Gillette. They got £4 billion worth of tangible assets. That means £27 billion they paid for the brands, the relationships with customers, the distribution channels, and so on and so forth. They're not stupid. Mm. Nestle bought Roundtree's. They didn't want a factory in York. That's the last thing they wanted, was a factory in York. It's not factories and offices and lorries that make profits. It's relationships with customers through the brands that we have. And what you've got to do is to understand how you can quantify this shareholder value thing. So the way I do, let me give you an example, a simple example. When I'm talking to small, medium enterprises, for example, and I talk about shareholder value added, I say, look, let's assume you're a small, medium enterprise. You've got £20,000 invested in your company. The cost of capital is 10%. And at the end of the year, you make £1,500 profit. You've actually destroyed £500 of the shareholder value. If you make £2,000, you've neither created nor destroyed shareholder value. If you make £2,500, you've created £500 worth of shareholder value. What numpty on planet Earth, even a small, medium enterprise, would want to destroy shareholder value? And we've got to be able to measure it. Now, the book I was talking about, it's called Marketing and Finance, sponsored by the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants. And it takes us through a step-by-step detailed process for working out whether a strategic plan is creating or destroying shareholder value. And it looks at things like the market and, you know, how susceptible to risk are things like the product. For example, you take iPod. When the iPod first came out, it was a very risky thing. Nobody knew it. Nobody understood it. Now everybody knows I, and there's very little risk attached to it. If you take something like men's cosmetics all those years ago, when it was new, it was quite risky. Nowadays, it's a well-established market for people like you and me, men's cosmetics, and so on and so forth. And then you get the market, you know, the market. How dodgy is the market? And, you know, have companies defined their market properly? You go back in history to Gestetner. They thought they were in the duplicator market. IBM in the 80s thought they were in the mainframe market. Kodak thought they were in the camera market. Nokia thought they were in the phones market, and so on and so forth. And then strategy, understanding things like market segmentation, value propositions, positioning and branding. All these things are susceptible to using the tools and techniques of qualified marketers. And if you look at profit, you know, I've seen so many plans in my life where somebody says, we're going to smash the competition. And you think, no, you're not. And what I usually do, that every plan I see shows gross margins on the main product going up. So I sneak along to the finance director and I say, can I have a quick history of this main product's gross profits over the past 5 years? And they've been going down. And suddenly this plan says they're going up. Now, all I'm saying is it's perfectly feasible to assess the riskiness of a strategy. And you can tell companies, I know whether a company is going to be successful. I mean, there was one company recently. I was at a conference, maybe it was about 3 years ago, and there were 65 managing directors there. And I was introduced as a professor of marketing. And they were all sitting there with their arms folded because they thought, who is this odious little toad of a marketing professor? And what's he going to tell us that's got anything to do with anything? Because they just had something like a 60% increase in their net profit. So I thought, this is going to be a great day for me. So I picked on the first guy whose name I could read. And I said, John, what was your net profit increase last year, John? And he pulled himself up to his 6'12" height and he said, 185%. And I said, wow. And then I said to the audience, the other 64 managing directors, I said, has anybody got a better net profit increase than that? And they answered, no, they hadn't. So I said, let's give John a round of applause. So you can imagine the enthusiasm with which they all applauded John. And I said, well, look, your peers have congratulated you, John. I said, can I just ask you a few questions to share with your audience? I said, did your market grow last year, John? This was a big, big company. I said, did your market grow last year, John? He said, yes. I said, by how much did it grow, John? And how much of your profit came from market growth? And he didn't know. I said, oh, well, fair enough then, John. I said, did you increase your market share last year, John? If you did, by how much did you increase your market share? And how much of your profit growth came from increased market share? Now, you know, listeners would know, if he couldn't answer the first question, he couldn't answer the second one. So I said, okay, John, let me ask you an easier question. I said, did you have any price increases last year, net of inflation? How much of your net profit growth came from that? He didn't know. I said, okay, let me ask you an easier question. Have you had any productivity improvements last year, John? And so on and so forth. By now, the other 64 managing directors were sitting there where they'd unfolded their arms and they were thinking, I hope this odious little toad of a professor doesn't ask me any questions like that, because it was quite obvious that if any of them had gone to if they've gone to a brain surgeon, they probably only had half a brain to examine or something like that. So, and you know that this company, you knew that company was going to go down the tubes, and it did later on. They were so arrogant and they didn't understand what causes profits. So the answer is profitable growth, shareholder value added. How do you measure it? It's not the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's the only thing at the end of the day that boards of directors care about.
Let's move on to the subject of the marketing profession now. And I think you've argued that the marketing profession is currently in a somewhat confused state. What would you say are the key contributors to that?
That's a very interesting question, because I think you have to go back in history about 30 years, maybe a bit more than that, when we lived in what we call in the academic community a product dominant logic world, where products ruled the world. And that was all changed by what was called relationship marketing that came from the Nordic school. And what they said, look, customers don't belong to marketing people. They belong to everybody in the company. And everybody said, oh, yes, of course, that's right. So marketers got pushed away from customers towards promotion. Then, of course, we had the dreaded digital came along, didn't it? The dreaded digital came along. And they said, oh, that's marketing. Yeah, that's marketing's role. So we got pushed further and further away from the boardroom. And, you know, the problem we've got is that while marketers are fiddling around with, you know, intelligence systems and blockchain and God knows what, you know, Rome is burning. Like, we've taken our eye off the ball of what markets are doing, you know, about, you know, what customers are doing. And we need to get back to basics. So what I've said is, again, in this little note I sent out on LinkedIn, a change to process necessary, which entails getting marketing back to basics. And this represents a major opportunity for our community. A recent article on the future of marketing in Harvard Business Review re-emphasized the need for marketers with traditional marketing expertise and claimed that these basic capabilities are missing from our community. And again, it said, there's an urgent need for the return of the informed generalist, marketers who are able to see the whole picture and orchestrate the right solution, unencumbered by specialization, generalists who can join up thinking and deliver a solution. And our current top marketing academic, a guy called Mark Tadejewski, who runs the, amongst other things, the Journal of Marketing Management, he said, the foundation of successful marketing strategy is the ability to understand markets and customers better than competitors and to allocate scarce resources through market segmentation, targeting and positioning to create superior customer value. And I've said, you know, I've said, look, in spite of so much criticism, including my own of the state of marketing, our research at Cranfield shows that successful marketers, they make a major contribution to corporate wealth by understanding markets, doing proper needs-based segmentation, developing quantified value propositions, competitive analysis, portfolio analysis, and managing marketplace risk, all encapsulated in a strategic marketing plan. And this is supported by a flurry of recent articles by the likes of McKinsey, Accenture, IBM, and others too numerous to mention here, giving evidence that organizations with chief marketing officers doing these things are substantially more successful than those with CMOs who don't drive strategy in these ways. So, you know, against this, I draw your attention to a company like Unilever. Now, I'm sorry, it's a fast-moving consumer goods company, but Unilever has just become number one on the FTSE ahead of AstraZeneca. And, you know, if you look at, I'm just trying to think of the name off the top of my head, of the name of the chief executive officer who did all this. I'll think of it, but in a minute, I'll think of it. But the point is, what he did, this guy, he got rid of all this short-term budgeting and forecasting. He worked out that they were wasting £250 million a year just doing forecasts and budgets and wasting time as well. So he got rid of all the short-termism, the quarterly reports and goodness knows what, and he focused on customers and markets. And it's no accident that over the 10 years this guy was in charge, the shares tripled in value. So, you know, there's some evidence that, you know, this short-termism stuff doesn't work and strategic marketing does work. I've got some more thoughts, but I'll stop just there because I'm sure that our poor listeners are getting sick to death with me.
I'm sure that's not the case. So when you're talking about marketing going back to basics, what you're talking about is marketers be looking at the market, understanding the market, segmenting and targeting that marketplace, and acting in a more general rather than kind of specialist tactic way.
Yeah, I mean, that's not instead of you know, the internet and any of that. All that's happened is that, you know, digital has armed us with a new set of wonderful, wonderful tools for understanding customers and markets better. But digital isn't marketing. It's the same way as cost cutting isn't marketing. It's not a strategy. It's just if you haven't got a robust strategic marketing strategy covering at least 3 years, it's not going to be possible ever to have a worthwhile digital strategy. One precedes the other, but I'm not trying to undermine digital in any way, shape or form. It's going to become a bigger part of our lives. We've got to understand it, embrace it, but we must remember that it only works properly. We can only make it effective if we understand our customers and our markets.
So if we're talking about marketing going back to basics, what does that mean for the qualifications of the marketing community?
Well, I'm very fortunate that I'm a professor at six of our top business schools, and I'm on advisory boards for marketing MSc programs, for example. And I'm also very close to the Chartered Institute of Marketing. So if you look at something like level seven, the postgraduate diploma in the Chartered Institute of Marketing, the curriculum is absolutely fantastic. It's robust, it's kept up to date, it covers all of those basics, and it qualifies people to be professional marketing managers and eventually marketing directors. And it's exactly the same at places like Cranfield and Warwick, who have fantastic MSc programs. When I teach on them, I'm on the board of the Cranfield one in particular, where we review on an annual basis, on an ongoing basis, the content of the strategic MSc program, and it's bang up to date. The quality of the students is very high. It's very rigorous, and I would employ anybody who's been on an MSc program in marketing from places like Henley and Warwick. I would personally employ them because I know that they've been properly trained and can take on the role of strategic marketing. That's my personal view.
What does your research show about the contribution of marketers to corporate wealth today?
Well, again, I could send you, but I won't bore you, the 127 pieces of research that we've got that shows what the contribution is. But it's fascinating. And I've already said during our conversation, Dave, that when I go to a company like those numpties that I was talking about at their conference, where they'd invited me along, and they obviously knew nothing about anything, they didn't know what was causing success, and they were bound to go bankrupt. They were just happened to be in a growth market. But I would say that I can tell when I look at any company's strategy, whether they're going to be profitable or whether they're not going to be profitable. If they're in a high growth market, it's less important because Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck can make profits in a high growth market. Fortunately, in a sense, those high growth days have gone. I mean, for example, it was much easier for me to be marketing and sales director of Canada Dry in the 1980s, because most markets were in high growth. So we enjoyed a wonderful, wonderful time. But since then, and I know particularly the B2B listeners who are joining us for this, I can tell you that it's hard work making money today. And I know, as I said, when I see chief executive officers, particularly of companies like SMEs, seeing the fog lifting from their eyes when I tell them about the joys of world-class strategic marketing and how it can be used, how it can be implemented, and how, much more importantly, it can be turned to profitability, they absolutely love it. And I can tell you, if you give you one example, there's a cartoon I've got, and it shows this chief marketing officer addressing the board. And he says, he's probably got bouffant hairstyle and suede booties, but he says, it's a great pity that our net profits are down by 40%. But the good news is our Facebook likes are up by 25%. And you get this blank expression on the faces of the directors of the company. And you think, what planet does this guy live on? Nobody gives a toss about Facebook likes, unless, of course, you can turn them into into pipeline leads that turn into profit, and you can prove it. But, you know, it's, there's only one thing that boards of directors will make boards of directors listen to marketers, and that is, can they prove that the strategies they're laying out for them will create short shareholder value? If they can do that, they will be welcomed with open arms, they will be embraced, they will be supported, they'll get the money they want, and they'll be a central part of strategy making, as opposed to floating around on the touchline doing a bit of digital and a bit of promotion. That's probably not the answer you wanted.
Okay.
I'm sorry I haven't got many views on this topic, Dave.
No, it's very clear what your view is, though, which is really interesting. So let's come on to a final area of focus, and I don't think we can talk today without touching on COVID-19. So you've argued that the impending recession that COVID has generated isn't going to disappear soon, and that the business response to the crisis by cutting costs is inappropriate. Can you take us through why that is?
Cost cutting isn't inappropriate as long as it's done judiciously. I mean, if you look at how companies can, you know, can increase value and increase profit, there are only four ways in which companies can do that. And the first one is to invest in projects that earn more than the cost of capital. Now, that translates into marketing by saying, invest in markets and customers that earn more than the cost of capital. It's got to be worth investing in those sorts of things. And then you get, beneath that, you get reduce assets in activities that earn less than the cost of capital. If that is the case, it's a blinding glimpse of the obvious that if you've got customers and markets that are earning less than the cost of capital, you should be cutting costs there, you know, cutting your suit accordingly. It just doesn't make sense to be throwing good money after bad. And then you get, you know, growing your profits from your existing investments. That's a whole new topic, but it's nonetheless very important. And of course, reducing risk, and you reduce risk by, as I say, having a deep understanding of what's going on in the market. But, you know, the point is, you take something as basic as Pareto's law or the Lorenz curve or the 80-20 rule, whatever you want to call it. One of the first things I've started doing nowadays with the COVID crisis is getting them to do the 80-20 rule. I get them to list their products and product groups along the top and their markets down the left, and put their sales in. And guess what? Every single time they discover that 20% of their customers and products make 80% of their revenue and profits. Why on earth are they faffing around and wasting money and trying to delight, this expression, we're going to delight our customers? I want to stab myself in the eye with a fork when I hear about that. The people you want to delight are the core markets, core customers. You can't be all things to all men. So by all means, reduce costs, let the accountants loose with areas of the business that need to be trimmed where we're not earning more than the cost of capital, or we're earning less than the cost of capital. But, you know, it's, to me, it's, you know, you can't do any of this. I mean, if you look at the 10 guidelines that I wrote, I think for, did I do them for you,
yeah,
Dave?
Webinar, yeah.
That's right, yeah. From memory, one of the first things was understand the value required by customers and quantify it financially. Well, if you can't get that right, you might just as well go and, you know, sing songs, you know, in the middle of the night. I mean, what's the point? It's so fundamental. Understanding what's going on in the market, segmenting it, and understanding the value that's required by the customers. And then what I talked about earlier, financially quantifying it. You know, we're supposed to help customers. We're supposed to create advantage for them, not just help them avoid disadvantage. There's a big difference between creating advantage and avoiding disadvantage. And if you can prove that you're creating advantage for them, and you can put a financial figure on it, and it's very, very difficult to do, but if you can do it, I'll tell you what, you'll never, ever have to worry about price. Never mind COVID or anything like that. You'll keep on making loads and loads of money. And I think the second, which I've already touched on, was focus on the markets and customers you want in the long term. That means you're going to have to get rid of some products, probably. You're going to have to trim your portfolio of products. You're probably going to have to trim your distribution network as well, because many distribution channels aren't particularly effective. You've got to be brutal about these things, but you can only do it if you've identified the markets and the customers you want to keep in the long term. The next thing you've got, improve the productivity of your promotional spend, particularly the sales force. I mean, it is amazing. There was a major, major piece of research done towards the end of last year, thousands and thousands of respondents across Europe. And the conclusion was that the marketing community sends out exactly the same messages to all parts of the market, to every bit of the media that they use, the same messages. You know, again, you might just as well go and set fire to the money, because it's a complete waste of time. It's why when you get home at night, well, of course you are at home and so am I, but when you get home at night and the post is being...
When you come downstairs.
The post is put all this rubbish through the door, direct mail. And you think, what numpty sent that stuff out? It's total waste of time. It's because some idiot, you know, if they said, yes, we sent out 100,000, we've got a 3% response rate. That means you really choked off 97% of the people you sent it to and really irritated them. But what I'm saying is, you know, look at the promotional spend. There are lots and lots of fabulous techniques and tools around for working out the effectiveness of your promotional spend. And I say, you know, especially the sales force, because all of that's changing now. It's probably no longer going to be viable to send people out the way we used to send them out. So that's a whole new area of study that we're embarking on. But I've already said six one was reduced costs in unproductive areas of the business. Of course, let the accountants loose on them. Let them get at it. Support them. Get the costs down. And again, I've said this. You know, work out your banker, key customers, the ones, the big ones, and give these customers to your top managers. Don't give them to Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck. Give them to your top managers. And by top managers, I mean people who are properly educated in business management, people who understand finance, people who understand economics, people who understand everything about a business, corporate culture. The sort of person that I have in mind is somebody who's probably educated at least to MBA standard, but the sort of person we were talking about earlier, someone who's got an MSc, shall we say, from Warwick, Henley, Cranfield, places like that. Certainly, although that's not absolutely essential, you want somebody who's a trained general manager in charge of these major customers, because they don't like being called on by Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, I can assure you. And that is a whole new area of study as well. I mean, I formed a research club at Cranfield, sponsored by 3M and Siemens and Rolls-Royce and the like, 25 years ago. It's called Global Best Practice Key Account Management. It's still going strong after 25 years. And I'll tell you what, it is a major, major area of marketing investment. And many companies get it wrong. I said, don't let your sales force do big deals. Otherwise, everybody will get major discounts within 5 minutes. I've said, selectively attack competitors' key customers. Don't be nice. Don't be nice. Selectively attack competitors' key customers that are attractive to you. And the final thing, overall, keep the heart of the business, your key products, your key markets, and your key customers. But I will say this, Dave. If you listen to what the old boy has to say, you know, I actually, before this interview started, I scribbled down some thoughts, and I called it some final thoughts from the old professor, Malcolm McDonald. And I've got four things. And the first one is, don't ask stupid questions about what customers want. Nobody knows what they want. No, they never have done, and they never will. Nobody asked Apple to invent iPods, iPads, iPhones, and the like. They just made lives more enjoyable for people. And it's exactly the same for the successful companies. They solve customers' problems, they create advantage for them, but don't ask them stupid questions about what they want. I mean, I've probably just got 2 minutes to tell you this. It's a bit like me in the 19th century doing some market research and get this horse and carriage. And I stop this horse and carriage. And I say to the four people inside, I say to the first one, I say, what would you like? And they say, thank you for asking, Malcolm. Could you go away and invent the internal combustion engine for me? And they then tell me what that is, you know, the associated corpuscular emission, et cetera, et cetera. I say, oh, thank you, I'll do that. Good idea. Second one says, could you go away and do ABS brakes for us? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. The third one says, what about windscreen wipers? And air conditioning. It's such a nonsensical idea. It's why most market research is wasted. And then one other thought, just this, it's so important. This value is what the customer needs, not what you're trying to sell them. It's a big philosophical question. That value is what the customer needs, not what you're trying to sell them. If it's the same thing, that's wonderful, but rarely is it the case in my experience. And the third one, I nearly finished, profit is a byproduct of doing something customers value. 11, never let's forget that. Profit is a byproduct of doing something customers value. I mean, profit's a bit like a sausage. It's great until you know what goes into it. But the best companies in the world, and this brings me to my last point, I've said, and I want you to listen to this carefully, Dave, because if we could run our companies like this, we'd all be millionaires. But I've said, a product that is great for the people who buy it, great for the people who make it, great for the people who sell it, great for all stakeholders, and great for the planet. And I've said, what could be easier than this? So I'll just say it once more. A product that is great for the people who buy it, great for the people who make it, great for the people who sell it, great for all stakeholders, and great for the planet. That's what the best companies in the world are doing as we sit here now. So thank you very much indeed.
No pressure there, then.
Thank you very much indeed, Dave, for asking me all these very difficult questions. And I probably haven't answered them satisfactorily, but I hope I've given somebody some food for thought.
You've been brilliant, Malcolm. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer them. You act as a consultant to businesses on the issues we've discussed. So maybe we could end by your letting people know how to get in touch with you if they want to find out more about that.
Okay, well, I know we don't use this medium, and nor should we, for selling, but my email address is lowercase m.mcdonald@cranfield.ac.uk. That's m.mcdonald, that's MCD, not as in as in hamburger, m.mcdonald@cranfield, one word, cranfield.ac.uk. So if there's anybody who is eventually going to listen to this podcast that I failed to insult, if you send me an email, I'll send you a personal insult back, I promise you.
Malcolm McDonald, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Dave. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you, and you. And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guest, Malcolm McDonald. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian and Josh Bench. And thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can. And email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. Check out our other webinars, podcasts, events, mentoring, blogs, newsletters, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.